their education levels. Another key problem involved sleeping on a soft surface, a couch, waterbed, or squishy mattress, and having an excess number of blankets. None of those factors applied in the case of his family. So I calculated that the standard reference statistic being used of a 1 in 1,000 risk was probably much lower for us, Barnaby said. By changing or eliminating certain risk factors, you can shift the risk curve and effectively change your chances or luck. Mandarin snuggled next to Mom and Dad for a year, and so did baby Jasmine when she arrived. Both girls are fine and beautiful and thriving. A lot of people might disagree with his decision on co-sleeping, while others wildly support it. The topic remains controversial. But the bigger issue is an important one. We can't remove all risks, and life is always about trade-offs, Barnaby said. He pointed out that there are statistical risks involved with taking the kids out any time in the car, but we do it anyway. What's important is that you understand the reality of the risks you're taking. Mark Twain popularized the expression lies, damned lies, and statistics, and it's very easy to get swayed by experts tossing around numbers or encouraging you to misinterpret them. If you hear a report, usually from a doctor on TV, that eating kale or running 10 miles a day reduces your risk of a particular disease by half, it could be that your odds went from 0.002 to 0.001. In practical terms, that 50% decrease doesn't mean anything at all. If you like kale, go ahead and make a salad. But don't expect it to be a major source of luck. Similarly, you can theoretically know that an 80% chance of rain predicts what will happen 8 out of 10 times with the meteorological conditions as they are. But all you really care about is whether the baseball game this afternoon is going to be canceled. If you understand the odds, you can play with them. So, for example, back in 1992, an Australian investor syndicate came up with a strategy for getting lucky in the lottery. Instead of buying just 1 or 2 or 3 tickets, they planned to win the Virginia lottery by buying a ticket for every possible combination. At the time, each of the $1 tickets had 6 bubbles that could be filled with a number from 1 to 44, which meant there were some 7 million combinations. Filling out all those little forms would take a very long time, so they bought blocks of tickets through more than 100 different retailers. It kept the stores humming. No one wants to be in line behind anyone who's there for 3 or 4 days, said one disgruntled Virginian in a public hearing after the lottery fix. The syndicate managed to get only 5 million of the 7 million combinations before time ran out, but the odds were on their side, and they won the $27 million jackpot. You probably don't want to try this at home. Even if you could borrow the money to buy all those tickets, most state lotteries are now dramatically harder to fix. Having the number of choices go up to 49 instead of 44 may not sound like a big deal, but it doubles the possible combinations to 14 million. And even if you win, you always run the risk of having to share the big bucks with other ticket holders who randomly pick the right combination. In major lotteries like the National Mega Millions drawings, it would be impossible to print the necessary number of tickets, no matter how many retailers you had on your side. But the Australian investors were right in their general theory. If you increase your chances, you increase your odds. When I first heard the story of the Virginia lottery, my thought was, yikes, the syndicate got only 5 million of the 7 million. They could still lose. Barnaby said his thought was, 5 out of 7, great odds. That's the funny thing about statistics and odds. They are just numbers, and we give them our own emotional overlay. As you are making your luck and living your life, you make very personal decisions on how much risk to take in everything from family to finance. One young guy I know spent a lot of time in his 20s ice climbing. He was strong and careful and certain that he wouldn't make the kind of mistakes that statistically lead to a high rate of accidents in the sport. But once he was good enough to be climbing increasingly treacherous routes and spending more and more time on the slippery slopes, he realized that he couldn't keep beating the odds. When you are climbing at a high level of difficulty, accidents happen that you can't predict. He put away his ropes. Other climbers keep going, up rocks and mountains and in high-risk sports. One of the most famous alpine climbers in the world, Uli Steck, died in 2017 when he was preparing to race up a treacherous ridge of Mount Everest. He had set speed records on famous peaks like the Matterhorn, and he once charged up every big peak in the Alps at a record-breaking pace, climbing 82 mountains, each more than 4,000 meters, in 62 days. His death at age 40 was sad, but Steck surely knew he was playing against tough odds. He made the choice that a life of thrills and adrenaline was worth the risk. You and I and my ice-climbing friend might have made a different choice. But in that way, we each get to define for ourselves what makes a lucky life. The next time Barnaby and I visited the Luck Lab, we took another walk in the woods. It was less muddy this time. No more shoes sacrificed to science. I mentioned that in our national survey, some 66% of people thought you could make luck for yourself by being willing to take risks. Barnaby didn't completely agree with them. Everybody has a different view of risk, and it's not necessarily true that more risk equals more luck, he said. Connecting risk and luck is deep in the American psyche. We used to revere the gutsy cowboy who rode across the plains to make his own luck, and now we exalt the cowboy entrepreneur who tosses away the rules, takes audacious risks, and rides triumphantly to glory. It makes for good movies and folklore, but not so much for reality. The luckiest and most successful people often look like they're taking risks, but they always have a floor under them so they can't fall too far, Barnaby said. I hear that again and again from people who have made fortunes. Instead of risking everything, they make their luck by seeing what others don't and capturing opportunity. As we continued to walk, I noticed a long, swooping bridge to one side of us, made of wooden slats and wire. It spanned a pond, and while there didn't seem to be much on the other side, I asked Barnaby if he wanted to walk across. I heard the bridge was designed and built by Princeton engineering students, Barnaby said. He climbed up a couple of steps and then walked unhesitatingly out to the center as the bridge swayed. Should I join you? I asked, staying on firm ground. He looked around for a moment and then shook his head no and came back. This bridge is a great example that sometimes there is an asymmetry to luck. The amount of good luck you can make on this bridge is limited, but the bad luck is high if you fall off, he said. Not all risks are worth taking. We headed back inside to the Luck Lab, and Barnaby told me that early in his career, he advised for an oil company. The man has done everything, which made him think a lot about different kinds of risk and how they pay off. As Barnaby explained it, geologists typically go out with sounding equipment to look for pockets in the earth where there may be oil. After they collect extensive data and find possibilities, and it's never a certainty, the company has to decide which spots to pursue. Drilling is expensive, so they can't drill everywhere. To get the highest possible yield, you drill for medium-sized fields that will yield profitability for the company. But there's also the pressure for huge finds in unexpected places that are expensive to explore. It's hard to go after both, so you have to choose one or the other. And those different approaches attract different kinds of risk-takers, whether they are engineers or executives, Barnaby said. In our own lives, we regularly make the same kinds of decisions. Go after the small percentage play that has a huge payoff, or take the safer course that yields less dramatic but more constant results. In other words, should you encourage your child when he watches a basketball game and says all he wants in life is to play in the NBA? Unless he's 6'7" and never misses a three-point shot, possibly not. We love hearing about people who think huge, take on the impossible, and win. But you can have an equally good life on a surer path and a safer bet. Taking the heroic path isn't the only way to luck, Barnaby said. Extraordinary outcomes are rare, and we do a disservice to ourselves if we think that's the only definition of making your luck. Following up on his oil drilling example, Barnaby pointed out that a petroleum engineer can decide to spend 10 years freezing in the Arctic looking for that undiscovered gusher that will change everything. Or he can go to the warm spot in Houston with predictable fields that will generate a steady return. Movie studios face the same question. They can take on the safe and somewhat predictable theme, hello, Batman, Part 18, or try something off the wall and different that will probably flop but may be a mega hit. A college senior thinking about his future makes a similar calculation. Go to dental school for a sure and secure future, or become an entrepreneur and invest everything in your idea for a startup selling ice cream sandwiches by mail. Living your life by statistics makes theoretical sense. You can see how many dentists go broke versus how many startup entrepreneurs. You can check how many people like ice cream and how many competitors you would have. Calculate your chances of success and decide the luckiest path. But the what are the odds approach is just not how most of us are wired. We make decisions based on popular information, or what our friends have done, or we follow our hearts, which leads to some very foolish risks. If your college roommate had a successful startup, you're probably more likely to jump in and try one too. We expect good outcomes, even when they are highly unlikely, and we ignore potential downsides. I was a big fan of the Caltech physicist Leonard Mlodinow, whose best-selling book, The Drunkard's Walk, had long been a favorite of mine. He had an appealing way of explaining statistical chance, and once, somewhat whimsically, wondered how many people would enter a state lottery if the likely outcome was presented as one person would win a fortune, millions of others would get nothing, and one person would die a violent death. Because that's pretty much what happens. Pulling together statistics on car accidents and estimates of how many people make an extra trip to buy a ticket, he figured there's about one additional car fatality per major lottery. But who ever takes that into account when deciding whether or not to buy a lottery ticket? Years ago, when I was the editor of a big magazine, we had a breakfast every month for everyone who worked at the company. Along with fruit platters and too many cream donuts, we served up sweepstakes tickets to everyone who attended. Then the CEO pulled numbers out of a hat to award the prizes. Dinner for two at a restaurant, gift baskets, a designer scarf. As the winners rushed forward to claim their prizes, at least one of them would invariably shout, "I can't believe it! I've never won anything before!" It's not a surprise, of course. Winning a sweepstakes or lottery of any kind means beating the odds. But Barnaby told me that his wife, Michelle, regularly entered the drawing at their local Trader Joe's for a week of free groceries. Thousands of people went to that very popular store, but she had won three times. "It doesn't make sense," he said. And yet, unexpected events, good and bad, happen all the time. Mathematicians like to point out that there's a big difference between asking how likely it is that Michelle will win three times and how likely it is that someone will win three times. Think of it this way. If 10,000 people drop their entries into the bowl each week, you have a 1 in 10,000 chance of winning. But there's a 100% chance that someone will win, and the same person winning twice in a few months isn't as unusual as it may sound. Mathematicians refer to it as the law of big numbers, and it gives us a new way of thinking about odds. Some years ago, a woman in New Jersey won the state lottery twice in 4 months. Even more amazing than Michelle's groceries, right? Reporters said she had beaten odds of 1 in 17 trillion. But then two statisticians at Purdue University, Drs. Stephen Samuels and George McCabe, begged to differ. They pointed out that those odds were based on a given person buying a single ticket for both lotteries and winning each time. But out of the millions and millions of people buying hundreds of millions of lottery tickets, the odds of a double winner somewhere in the country were dramatically different. 1 in 17 trillion? Nope, more like 1 in 30. Another classic example is the birthday party problem. If you're going to a party that has 23 people, it's likely that two people in the room have the same birthday. But if you want to be in a room where it's likely that someone has your birthday, you'd need a much bigger crowd, something like 183 people. And sometimes it's important to remember that it's okay to toss probabilities out the window and decide that you're going to make your own luck. Barnaby thought that one guy who would know a lot about that was his acquaintance Doug Rausch, who spent many years running Trader Joe's nationally. "So that's how Michelle won," I said. "It was fixed." "Absolutely not. He's not even there anymore," Barnaby insisted. So we gave Rausch a call, and I was quickly convinced that he knew nothing about the mystery of Michelle and the free groceries. But he knew a lot of other stuff about making luck in the grocery business. One of the early employees of Trader Joe's when it was a small store in Los Angeles Roush had some early successes, including fame as the guy who dreamed up all-American nut butter. Higher in protein than peanut butter and significantly less expensive, and we sold hundreds of thousands of pounds, he told us, still proud all these years later. The peanut crop in America had failed one year, driving up the price of the lunchtime staple, and he had the idea to make a substitute out of cottonseed. The development was complicated, but mostly it taught him the important lesson that luck comes when you tap into a more innovative mindset. Instead of just looking at what exists, you start thinking about what doesn't exist and what could exist. Turning cottonseed into peanuts, which sounds like magic, wasn't the only risk Roush took. He came up with a plan to leapfrog the company 3,000 miles away, expanding from California to the East Coast. Big risk? More like crazy, stupid, ridiculous risk. The owners and the CEO liked the idea, but the founder of the company, Joe Colombe, who had since left, took him out to lunch to tell him not to sell his house in California when he moved to Boston. It couldn't work. He would be back. I thought, this is the founder of Trader Joe's. It's like God telling me that I'm going to fail, Roush said. In case that divine message wasn't enough, the solid New Englander Tom Chappell, who had started the toothpaste company Tom's of Maine, took Roush out to dinner and was equally dubious. Tom didn't think anything about the company would transfer well, including the employee uniforms. Tom said, "You're not going to keep the Hawaiian shirts, are you? I mean, they make sense in California, the beach, the surfers, but you get up in Boston, you look like a bunch of idiots," Roush recalled. Tom also thought the entire store model, with no counters or service or fresh deli, would fail. Boston was the capital of fresh fish. Why would anybody buy frozen fish? I came away from that dinner incredibly depressed. I even had our shirt supplier do a long-sleeved Hawaiian shirt to see what it would look like, Roush said. The long-sleeved Hawaiian shirt looked as ridiculous as it sounds, so Roush decided to risk the long odds everyone predicted and come east with Hawaiian shirts and frozen fish. If the odds were against him, he would make his own odds, sticking with the model he believed in. It was slow, it was hard, it was a slog and always a struggle, Roush told us. But that's the way businesses go, and life, too. It's not an overnight success many times. You can't change who you are to be something else. You have to believe in yourself and have the courage to keep going. Roush and his team stuck with the plan and kept expanding up and down the East Coast. Roush eventually became president of Trader Joe's nationwide, and by the time he left in 2008, he had opened 104 stores. Going against the odds won't always work, but the big success story is rarely the one people predict. The odds said that Trader Joe's would do better in Boston with the employees wearing nice embroidered shirts and selling fresh fish from behind counters. Roush used his own instincts and research and insights into the food business to take a different approach. Figuring out whether or not to gamble is a simple equation, or at least it is for mathematicians. You just multiply the odds of something occurring times the expected payoff. So, for example, if you have a 10% shot at winning $1,000, you multiply 10% by 1,000 and get 100. Theoretically, you should be willing to put in up to $100 for the opportunity. But in real life, odds and potential payoffs aren't always so clear, and emotions come into play too. I'd see this problem as presenting a 90% likelihood that I'm going to lose whatever I put in. So maybe I'd risk $5. This explains why I don't have a career in private equity or venture capital. Did Doug Roush have a 10% chance of succeeding when he moved Trader Joe's to Boston? 20%? 5? Every action he took changed the odds, and ultimately that's what's important in making your own luck. Shortly after talking to Roush, I got a call from an agent informing me that I was being considered to head up a very exciting project. A big list of potential people had been winnowed down, and she thought about 10 names were still in the running. I didn't get too excited. In fact, I immediately told myself that it wouldn't happen. A 1 in 10 shot wasn't very good. The other people were very talented. I'd just ignore it and see what happened. But wait a minute. Was there a way to change those odds? My natural instinct was to back away, If you expect nothing, you don't get disappointed. But you also don't get lucky. So I thought about what might set me apart. I called a few people. I sent a funny email. I whipped out a previous project I'd done that was similar and might make a difference. Maybe I didn't start as the obvious choice, but Hawaiian shirts in Boston weren't a shoe-in either. Somebody had to make them lucky. A week later, I got a call that the contenders had been narrowed to 4, and the people making the decision could meet me the following Wednesday. As it happened, I was supposed to be flying to the Bahamas to give a speech. But make your opportunities. Be the statistic you want to be. I paid a big fee to change my flight to the next day and still got there in time for the speech. I prepared for the meeting and gave it my all. As I wrote this, I didn't yet know whether I got the project. But it doesn't matter. I did everything I could to shift the odds in my favor. One way or another, I worked to make the luck happen. And when you look at your life, knowing you've pushed and believed and tried to change the odds is what makes you feel lucky. I chatted about that with a woman named Christy Clark, who lives in Boulder, Colorado. Or she used to live in Boulder. When we spoke, she told me that the very next week, she and her husband and their first-grade daughter were moving full-time to Paris. "How fabulous," I said. In terms of personal risk-taking, it was one of the bolder moves I've heard. Intrigued by Paris since she was a kid in New Jersey, Christy married her high school sweetheart, Cliff, and they visited the beautiful city on their honeymoon and again with their baby daughter. They took vacations there and eventually bought and renovated a gorgeous apartment near Saint-Germain-des-Prés. It started to seem right to her to have a new adventure. Moving to Paris with a young child when you don't speak French sounds pretty dicey, but Christy had done everything she could to make sure it would work. "We have a wonderful life in Boulder, but my heart sings when I'm in Paris," she said. As a psychotherapist in private practice, she regularly told couples to make luck and love by trying things they'd never done before. "Always ask yourself the question of why you're doing something," she said. "Am I doing it because it's familiar? Change is hard and scary, but think of all the luck you can make if you're willing to feel a little uncomfortable." For days after I spoke to Christy, I couldn't stop thinking about her. I imagined her wandering through the Louvre and eating pain au chocolat and playing with her daughter in the Luxembourg Gardens. Had she increased her odds for a lucky life? Maybe some statistic shows how many people are happy in Boulder versus Paris, and no doubt some mathematician could work out the odds for marital bliss if you move to your dream city instead of staying put. But if so, I would respectfully tell Christy to ignore all of them. There are good days and bad ones in any life, and you make luck by trying to have more of one than the other. Maybe doing what makes your heart sing is one way to become the statistic you want to be. Part 2. How to Get Lucky. I have noticed that even those who assert that everything is predestined and that we can change nothing about it still look both ways before they cross the street. Stephen Hawking. Chapter 4. Skate to Where the Puck Will Be. Be in the place where opportunity can find you. Know that one thing leads to another. It's okay to move away from Mom. Why Mother Teresa flew first class. After spending Mondays and Tuesdays at his luck lab in Princeton, Barnaby would come to our weekly Wednesday get-togethers full of new ideas and theories. The first question when he came to New York was always where we would meet. I had one or two favorite spots in the city, but now the range of my hangouts expanded dramatically. A new restaurant in Columbus Circle, the Low Boathouse in Central Park, a coffee bar on the West Side. Barnaby was always looking for someplace better than where he'd been before. "Where you spend your time is important," Barnaby told me one day as we sat down in one of those shared workspaces that have been proliferating in big cities. "To get lucky, you have to be in a place where opportunities are going to be around you," he said. He told me that in thinking about how place affects luck, he kept coming back to hockey great Wayne Gretzky. "He had an amazing insight about making luck," Barnaby said. Gretzky was on 4 Stanley Cup winning teams in the 1980s and 1990s and set extraordinary scoring records that still stand. When he was asked to explain how he scored so many goals, he always had one answer. "I skate to where the puck will be." I tried not to let my disappointment show. If Barnaby thought that was brilliant, maybe it was, but really? Skate to where the puck will be, I repeated. Barnaby nodded. It's really important in life, not just hockey, because lucky people put themselves in places where opportunity comes. Then they can wait calmly and capture the luck as it approaches. But doesn't everybody do that, I asked. Barnaby shook his head. Most people stay home watching television. I laughed. He was right. Recent statistics from Nielsen say that Americans spend about 5 hours a day watching TV in one form or another, plus another 2 hours or so consuming media on their phones and tablets. 7 hours a day is pretty much a full-time job. But unless you're prepping to be a judge on Dancing with the Stars, you're not going to get lucky by sitting home and watching television. Luck comes from being in a place where you can take advantage of the unexpected. Your couch is not one of those spots. We should make stickers to put on TVs that read, Luck Killer, Barnaby joked. I reminded him that I used to be a television producer, but I got the point. Gretzky's line about skating to where the puck would be was funny, but also practical and true. Because when the puck got to him, he was ready, and also often the only one there. You can score all sorts of real and proverbial goals by being in the right place for positive things to happen, whether you're looking for a job, a spouse, or a sports trophy. I'd already learned that lucky events aren't nearly as haphazard as they may appear. Being in the right place at the right time can be a matter of sheer chance, but just as often, some reasoned trajectory got you to that spot. If you're trying to get lucky, you have to think about where you're headed and where the puck will be. I thought of a story I'd heard about Oscar-winning actress Charlize Theron, who left her home country of South Africa after a string of bad events in an unusually dramatic childhood. Her mother shot and killed Theron's alcoholic father in self-defense. There were no charges, and Theron moved to Italy and then America, looking for better luck. It didn't happen immediately. She wanted to be a dancer, but her knees gave out. She was so depressed that her mother told her to come back home. But at age 19, she went to Los Angeles to give herself one last chance. It wasn't looking good until she had a screaming fit in a bank when a teller refused to cash the check her mom had sent from South Africa. If you're wondering where the luck part comes in, hang on. A man standing in the bank happened to be a talent agent. He saw this beautiful woman emoting dramatically and gave her his business card. That launched her career. Now, I'm not suggesting that exploding in rage is the way to get lucky. But by dragging herself to Los Angeles after all that had gone wrong, Theron put herself in a place where opportunities were most likely to happen. If she'd given up and gone back to South Africa, everyone at home would have understood and consoled her on her hard luck. Instead, she gave herself the chance to get lucky, and the 2004 Academy Award for Best Actress ended up on her mantle rather than someone else's. Americans have a reputation for being always on the go, but it turns out that making big moves like Theron did is unusual here. According to an analysis in the New York Times, a scant 20% of Americans live more than a couple of hours' drive away from their moms, and half of all grown-ups in the country stay within 18 miles of those moms. I am a great fan of mothers, but they are not necessarily the source of all luck. Moving away from mom can lead to new connections and better possibilities. Grabbing at luck can be complicated because opportunities aren't always predictable. You can move to Los Angeles planning to audition for commercials, but instead you throw a tantrum in a bank, get an agent, take acting classes, and end up playing a serious role that wins you an Oscar. Each of those events, the tantrum in the bank, getting an agent, could have numerous different outcomes, and one doesn't lead inexorably to the next. You have to see the possibility and grab it. Barnaby was full of examples of people who had made luck by going where the opportunities would be. The Greek shipping magnate Aristotle Onassis didn't start out lucky. His family lost everything during the Greco-Turkish War, and he fled to Buenos Aires as a teenager. But even when Onassis was too broke to eat out, he would go to the most expensive hotel and order tea. He understood that if you want to be rich, you go where the rich people are, Barnaby said. Onassis broke a few rules along the way, like getting a job as a telephone engineer so that he could listen in on other people's business calls and figure out his own angles. He always put himself in a place where he could meet the people who would help him. It's probably excessive to say that this rule led him to be one of the richest men in the world, the lover of opera diva Maria Callas, and the husband to widow Jacqueline Kennedy. But the determined effort to make his own luck certainly helped him rebound, and his go-for-it principles still resonate. I probably wouldn't use my last dime for tea in a fancy hotel, but maybe that's why I'm not as rich as Onassis. To get lucky, you have to be in a place where you can make opportunities. It's always easy to find reasons and excuses not to do something, and a defeatist attitude can sometimes even seem like the rational one. Maybe it is, but it's not the one that will make you lucky. Fear and lack of confidence are great inhibitors of luck because they keep you from going after what you want and making the connections that will get you there, Barnaby said. You're not a good target for luck when you're sitting at home depressed or hiding under the covers in bed. Unlike the tooth fairy, luck doesn't sneak in while you sleep. If you want to make luck, you have to ratchet up your courage and try the unexpected. Barnaby was convinced that the Gretzky principle of going where the puck will be works for everyone, and the secret was just adapting it to your own objectives. Even the saintly need to make luck. It's why Mother Teresa flew first class, Barnaby said. She could raise more money for her charities on a first-class flight from India to London than almost any other place. As soon as I got home, I checked that one out. For most of her life, Mother Teresa lived in India and dedicated her life to the people she described as the unwanted, unloved, and uncared for in society. She started a congregation called the Missionaries of Charity, which expanded rapidly over the years, and by the time she died in 1997, it included thousands of nuns in more than 100 countries, all of them vowing to give wholehearted free service to the poorest of the poor. Mother Teresa quickly figured out that you need a lot of money to take care of the poor and forgotten, and she was intent on gathering charitable donations. Though she believed that understanding the poor meant living among them, she often flew in the first-class cabin of airplanes. She got some criticism for that, but being in the front of the plane on her frequent travels ultimately brought luck that she could spread far. Talking to people on long flights from India to London and elsewhere gave her a captive fundraising audience and generated some of her biggest contributions. She understood that the executive who could afford seat 1A was probably more able to contribute generously to her cause than the guy in the middle seat of the last row in economy. In person, this small and intent woman was hard to turn down. Her passion was her power. Mother Teresa was canonized by the Catholic Church in 2016 as Saint Teresa of Calcutta. The canonization caused some controversy, though it didn't mention her travel arrangements, and even in her down-to-earth days, critics sometimes pointed out her many connections with dubious, albeit rich, executives and dictators. More positively, she did whatever was necessary to help fund her important activities and bring some luck to the neediest. Sometimes she found the people who could help in India, and sometimes at international meetings, and sometimes just walking to the bathroom in the first-class section of the airplane. She went where the donors would be. An 80s new wave rock band called The Fix had a hit song called One Thing Leads to Another. Fans were probably more interested in the hot dance beat than the philosophical reasoning behind the words, but the title also hits on a simple truth. Because in life and luck, one thing does lead to another. You set the stage for one positive result, and others will follow from it. And often, the luck gets bigger and bigger. As the writer E.B. White charmingly put it, there's no limit to how complicated things can get, on account of one thing always leading to another. People with big ambitions tend to cluster together with some implicit understanding that luck feeds luck. When Mark Zuckerberg was a Harvard undergraduate and started Facebook, he moved to Palo Alto for a summer to give his company the best chance of being lucky. He went where the luck would be. In that tech-focused environment, one thing definitely led to another, because one person led to another. Zuckerberg hired Sean Parker, who had started Napster, to be president of his budding company. Looking for investments, Parker went to Reid Hoffman, who headed the social networking site LinkedIn. Hoffman liked the idea, but couldn't invest. He thought it was a conflict of interest. So he introduced Parker to Peter Thiel, who he had worked with at PayPal, and Zuckerberg got his first $500,000 angel investment. Zuckerberg profited, hugely as it turned out, by being in a place where luck and support could flow his way. For Zuckerberg and Facebook, the luck happened when one person led to another, Parker to Hoffman to Thiel. If you have a brilliant idea for a startup that needs money to get underway, you've probably already thought about moving to Silicon Valley, or at least taking a trip there. You can splurge for lunch at the beautiful Madeira restaurant on Sand Hill Road and take it as a tax write-off, since there's a pretty good chance that the person at the next table is someone who can help. You're not going to accost him while he's eating his tuna tartare, but the chance of making the right connection is better when you're in the midst of the action and a couple of blocks from the offices of the most powerful venture capitalist in the world. You've put yourself in the place where lucky opportunities are more likely to happen. But before you buy your one-way plane ticket to San Francisco, it's worth remembering that the spots offering the biggest opportunities, like Silicon Valley or Hollywood, are also the places where you face the greatest competition. Barnaby told me that biologists have noticed this in the natural world for a long time and call it ideal free distribution, noting that more animals gather in the spots richest in resources. For a squirrel, a grassy area with lots of nuts and fruits scattered on the ground might seem like the perfect place to hang out. But if all the other squirrels are there too, and you're on the small side and don't have sharp claws, maybe you're better off on the less fertile land down the road. You may not get quite as many nuts and berries, but you can do just fine, thank you, and lead a perfectly nice life, even in the winter. The same theory holds for human beings looking to get lucky in finding a job or a lover or a chance to get rich. You want to go to the places that have the best opportunities and where you can compete. If you're an entrepreneur with a small startup and are barely making a go of it at home in rural Indiana, maybe you need to develop it a bit more before heading to Silicon Valley. On the other hand, if the company is soaring and you're doing a lot better than anyone else you know in town, you might want to take the leap to the coast. The bold move works to make you lucky only when you're ready to take it. A couple of months earlier, I met a young woman named Alice Brooks when we were both in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to speak at a women's leadership conference, a great place for lucky things to happen. I had given the keynote address, and she led an afternoon seminar, but we connected in a car on the way back to the airport and then couldn't stop talking. For once, I was glad that we had a long wait for our planes. Alice took advantage of being in the right place after she graduated from MIT in 2010 and went to Stanford to get a graduate degree in mechanical engineering. She was one of the few women in the program, and fired up by the entrepreneurial spirit encouraged at Stanford, she decided she wanted to create a toy for little girls that encouraged them to be as excited about engineering as she was. She imagined a toy where little girls could design a project and then build and wire it. When I was a little girl, I asked for a Barbie for Christmas, and my dad gave me a saw instead. So I built dolls in a dollhouse, she said with a laugh. That's just the kind of experience girls need. At Stanford, she began to design toys for girls with flashing lights and circuits, and along with her friend Bettina Chen, who was also in the engineering program, decided to start a company. A great idea, but then everybody in Silicon Valley has a great idea. They worked every element in the luck chain to make the idea a success. Finding the right contacts, crowdsourcing, getting mentors, being out in the marketplace where chance events could occur. Then they got themselves into a position where many entrepreneurs want to be, on the TV show Shark Tank. If you've never watched that program, you have to trust me that it's a lot more entertaining than it might sound. The Sharks are five hugely successful business people, titans of industry, the show calls them, who listen to pitches from entrepreneurs and decide if they want to invest money, their own, in the startup companies. Produced by Mark Burnett, who launched into reality television years ago with the show Survivor, Shark Tank is a kind of survivor for capitalists. The show has gotten so popular that the producers get some 40,000 applications every year from people who want to swim into the tank. But they also go out looking for entrepreneurs who would make good TV. And it didn't take them long to hear about two attractive Stanford engineers making a smart toy for girls. Brooks told me she was flattered the first time the producers called, but she turned them down. She recognized that while the show was meant to be fun for viewers, The Sharks were also shrewd business people looking to invest with savvy entrepreneurs who had potentially profitable companies. She'd get one chance to impress them. Being in the right place doesn't help if you're not ready to take full advantage of the opportunity. She wanted her company to have bigger sales and a more impressive story before she went on the show. Finally, the company was in a position where she felt ready to say yes to the producers. We were going to be the first episode on season 6, so we watched the previous 5 seasons and took notes on every question that got asked, Alice said. Then we divided up the questions so that when we were asked something, we could answer immediately and not have to look at each other. Being on that TV show was definitely the right place, and their smooth presentation and quick answers impressed the group. The results were a great example of luck favoring the prepared. Billionaire Mark Cuban invested $250,000 for 2.5% of their company. They already had sales of $1.7 million when they appeared on the show, and those soared to some $5 million the following year. A few years later, in January 2016, they sold out to a Wisconsin-based toy company, making Brooks very rich before her 30th birthday. In trying to figure out how to skate where the puck will be, it helps to listen to the full advice Gretzky got from his hockey-obsessed dad. Even though Gretzky was naturally talented from a young age, his dad drilled him on the essentials of the game. In his autobiography, Gretzky reported that their conversations would go like this. Dad, where's the last place a guy looks before he passes it? Young Wayne, the guy he's passing to. Dad, where do you skate? Young Wayne, to where the puck is going, not where it's been. It's easy to understand that you want to skate to where the puck will be, but the second part of that sentence is equally important. You don't want to skate to where the puck has already been. In looking for luck or success, it's natural to go where others have already found it. You may find it there. Scientists tell us that lightning absolutely does strike twice in the same spot. But it's also possible that the biggest luck opportunities will have moved on. Everybody else is clustering in the previously lucky area, so you might do well to try to figure out where that puck is going. Young entrepreneurs like Alice are always trying different versions of their company and staying flexible enough to move toward an ever-changing future. She brought an early version of her building toys to families around town so she could watch how little girls played with them, and then she adapted the toy. Being willing to work hard and constantly change her plan increased her chances for success. Startup companies are always talking about their beta version, which means they're still trying stuff out and looking for ways to improve. Or they say they're in version 2.0, which means the first plan didn't work, and they've moved on to another one. Both of these approaches are valuable for your own life, too. When the rules are changing as they always are, the only way to stay ahead is to stay ahead. Allow yourself to be in your own beta version, or keep moving forward to life 2.0. You're not guaranteed a multi-million dollar payout, but being able to look forward rather than backward does improve your chances. Young entrepreneurs aren't really much different from every other species that needs to evolve. Barnaby spent many years studying ornithology. Did I mention he has eclectic interests? And as we talked one day, he brought up a bird called the rock dove that used to live on the Mediterranean coast in Europe and North Africa. As cities grew, there were more chances to get lucky finding food away from the coast, and many of the doves moved inland. They continued to follow opportunities to be where the food would be. Rock doves are now called pigeons. Perhaps you've seen them in your favorite city? Similarly, raptors were never city birds until a red-tailed hawk decided that the ornate molding of a very nice building on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan was a good place for his nest. Named Pale Male by a writer, he became a local celebrity when the wealthy residents of the building decided they didn't want him there and dismantled the nest. Bird enthusiasts and the Audubon Society intervened, and eventually the nest was rebuilt with a reported $40,000 supporting platform beneath it to keep any debris from falling on pedestrians below. Pale Male has now been at his penthouse perch more than 25 years, and with a succession of mates, 8 at last count, has sent many offspring into the world. There are now reports of other red-tailed hawks nesting all over the city, including on the Plaza Hotel. The rock doves and pale male got lucky by moving away from the spots that had been right in the past and looking for future opportunities. Doing that can feel like a bit of a risk, but it's the kind that can pay off for animals of all varieties, including people. Being in the right place to get lucky can sometimes be very literal. Back in the 1972 Olympics, American sprinters Ray Robinson and Eddie Hart were favorites to medal in the 100 and 200 meter races. But their coach had an outdated schedule for the qualifying rounds, and they missed their quarterfinal contests. There was no pleading the case. They were eliminated. That story resonates over the decades because it seems so outrageously unfair. Even those who never previously heard of Robinson and Hart know that they must have driven themselves and trained for years in order to make the Olympics in the first place. The coach took the fall and accepted all the blame, but if you're not in the right place, you can't get lucky. So that brings us back to Gretzky, always making sure he got to a place where he could become lucky. He had one other insight that works in life as well as hockey. You miss 100% of the shots you don't take. In other words, you can't get lucky unless you put yourself on the line. And for that, it's necessary to pull yourself out of a comfort zone, and definitely out of bed, and meet the people who can make one thing lead to another. From the outside, it may look like you've been lucky, but you've really just skated to where the puck is going next. Chapter 5. Connect to the power of other people. Identify new networks. Talk to the guy next to you on the plane. Give luck to get luck. Rely on the strength of weak ties. Go to every party. Shortly after discussing an Elena Ferrante novel at my book club one evening, we all drifted over to the table which had been set up for dessert. As we tucked into fruit and gelato, and chocolate cookies, let's admit, one of the women said she had an announcement. Her husband had a friend who used to work with a talented guy in the digital world who just got fired and needed a new job. Did anybody have any leads? I took another strawberry. What? Her husband had a friend who used to work with... The connection sounded as baffling as trying to figure out who really wrote the Elena Ferrante novels. The guy who needed the job was Sri Srinivasan, and I shouldn't have been surprised to find out that Barnaby knew him, since Sri clearly had a huge network. How else would an Indian journalist who was born in Tokyo end up being discussed by a bunch of women in an Upper East Side book group? When I checked out his story, Sri turned out to be the perfect example of Barnaby's next principle, that you make luck through other people. Sri was already well known in the social media world when he was hired as the first chief digital officer of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, a position created just for him. He considered it a dream job. But after 3 years, the Met decided to cut back top staff, and in June 2016, he was let go. He said later that his first reaction was panic, and he thought about retreating. Climbing into a hole is a natural reaction when you're down, but unless you're a badger, holes don't lead anywhere. So he decided to use his many friends and followers on social media for support. He announced his situation on Facebook and said that he usually walked for 5 miles every day. And now that he had more time, it would be 10 miles. He invited people to sign up to walk and talk with him and put up a form that read, "If there's one thing Sri should consider doing next, it is..." Some 1,300 people reached out to him in what he called a global digital hug. He was apparently being discussed everywhere, including at my book club. By the end of the month, he had a new job as chief digital officer for the city of New York, a much bigger job than where he had been. Sri's good luck revolved around using his connections and his extended network in a very public way. When his new position was announced, he posted, "I got this role because I was open and frank and asked for help. I think the more we are all clear about the help we need, the more that people can help us." It's probably fair to say that more often than not, luck depends on other people. Harvard Law School professor Lawrence Lessig has argued that the more interconnected we are, the more creative and innovative we become. Expanding on this idea, writer Stephen Johnson points out in his book, Where Good Ideas Come From, that during the Renaissance, breakthroughs arose from the inventive genius, the rogue visionary who somehow sees beyond the horizon that limits his contemporaries, Da Vinci, Copernicus, Galileo. But after 1800, there was a huge change, and now most innovation occurs in collaborative environments. Rather than sitting alone at a desk and hoping for a eureka moment, most creative people are sharing ideas and building on one another's work. Executives and investors are talking to one another about possibilities. In our more networked world, working with other people creates luck. A simple secret of luck is to be with the people who can and will cause good things to happen for you. And it's not always who you think. Family and friends may be the bulwarks of support in most of your life, but the connections that propel you into the luck stratosphere are sometimes the most unexpected. The much-admired sociologist Mark Granovetter, who has degrees from Princeton and Harvard and is now a chaired professor of sociology at Stanford, refers to this as the strength of weak ties. You have strong ties with people like close friends or colleagues whom you see at least once a week, and weak ties with those you encounter less frequently. Interestingly, it's the weak ties that usually matter, whether you're looking to land a potential mate or a new job in digital media. You and your best friends already know most of the same people. You have overlapping social circles, as the sociologists like to say. But those with whom you're more weakly tied, like Shri and the ladies at the book club, probably have an entirely different social network. Connecting with them opens up a whole new community of possibilities. And because each new person is connected to many others, your possibilities are suddenly vastly larger. Granovetter's insight into the wonderfully oxymoronic strength of weak ties has inspired complex studies about networks and how information and luck spread. People who know how to play the networking game often end up looking like the luckiest ones around. Barnaby told me about his friend Lara Galinsky, who regularly uses the power of networks at conferences she runs. A consultant to many nonprofit organizations, she organizes luck circles instead of the standard bonding exercises that many of us have come to dread. Beach Olympics, anyone? Barnaby and I met Lara at a local cafe for breakfast, and over oatmeal and iced tea, she explained that her goal is to help everyone increase their opportunities for lucky events and connections to occur. She starts by dividing people into random groups of five, the core luck circle. Each person tells the group one thing that he or she needs to get lucky, something that would make a real difference in life. Then the groups mingle, and people walk around talking to one another and seeing if they can spread luck. As you move around, you're carrying five people's dreams in your pocket, Lara told us as she sipped her tea. It's random, controlled chaos. In the din, we'll regularly hear a shout of delight as someone makes a connection that can create luck. Lara's luck circles were inspired by emergence theory, the idea that small things can interact and connect to create bigger payoffs. She transferred the academic theory to real life in her conferences, with the small circle leading to the bigger circle. After you state the one thing you need to get lucky in life, huge repercussions occur when others know about it and are inspired to help. As people move around, their paths cross, strangers become acquaintances, and somebody you never imagined has exactly what you need to get lucky. Lara described one luck circle she ran where a young woman told her group of five that she wanted to get a job at a particular national foundation. Nobody in the group had an immediate way to help her. But as the small group expanded to the larger one, the foundation name got bandied about, and it didn't take very long for someone to remember a colleague who had once worked there and could make the right introduction. Wow! The young woman couldn't believe her luck. She just said the right words and the luck popped up. Luck sounds mystical, but it starts from the very grounded place of knowing what you want, Lara told us. Being declarative about your own desires and putting them into the world creates the conditions for luck. When you have clear ideas of what you want and see the world as something you can affect, you elicit lucky reactions. It's about openness and possibility and capturing chance. Mathematicians would be quick to tell you that it was statistically reasonable that someone in the room was able to connect with the young woman's luck request. The more people you know, the more quickly your message will be spread, and the more connections you can make. Some of the most impressive work in exploring the power of networks has been done by a professor named Albert Laszlo Barabasi. He has so many professional titles that it seems like he could get lucky networking with himself. He's a professor of physics as well as of computer and information science at Northeastern University, runs that school's Center for Complex Network Research, and has appointments at Harvard Medical School and two major teaching hospitals. Born in Transylvania, Romania, he lectures so often around the world that it's a surprise he never ran into Mother Teresa on an airplane. To explain how information and luck spread, Dr. Barabasi gives the example of a cocktail party with 100 people who don't know one another. The host mentions to one of the guests, we'll call him John, that the red wine in the unmarked decanter is actually a rare and valuable vintage. The host figures that his wine is pretty safe. After all, how many people can John meet and share the information with during the course of the party? The answer is, a lot more than you think. The cocktail party turns out to be like Lara's luck circles. What start out as small interactions can spiral into big payoffs. So at the start of the party, the guests will naturally break off into groups of two or three people to chat. The tidbit about the expensive wine is a good icebreaker, so John will surely share the news with his new acquaintances. Eventually, everyone in the group will drift off to refresh a drink or grab an hors d'oeuvre or meet more people. If you figure that each of the three people in John's original group joins another group of three, the story of the vintage wine can now spread to 9 more people. And eventually, those 9 will wander to other groups with their news. According to Dr. Barabasi, the mathematicians Paul Erdős and Alfred Rainey studied the problem and concluded that it would take just 30 minutes to form a single invisible social web that includes all the guests in the room. Just by going to that party and moving around, you can get lucky enough to taste the vintage wine. But it also turns out that some parties will be luckier than others, as will some cities and towns and universities. Cornell sociology professor Victor Nee has been doing research to find out how people create luck for one another in a big city environment, and why big cities tend to have so many creative and academic clusters. Doing research on knowledge-based economies, Nee noticed that after the financial meltdown of 2008, New York City rebounded with its usual strongholds in finance and advertising and arts, but it also developed what he called an innovation cluster that made it the second largest technology economy in the country, behind only Silicon Valley and its epicenter at Stanford. He was curious to figure out what was behind both the resilience and the surge in innovation. Barnaby and Nee often take walks together to toss around academic ideas, and one sunny morning I joined them for a stroll through Central Park. Nee had his English Cocker Spaniel at his side. The park was both beautifully peaceful and very busy, with joggers and bicyclists circling the reservoir and people holding casual meetings as they drank coffee outside the Loeb Boathouse. Nee's well-behaved spaniel, named Dustin, got attention from a variety of poodles and mutts and French bulldogs, and it was easy to see how New York could feel like a very small community as the various dog owners started chatting together. Nee told us that as he did research into innovation in New York, he realized that the spatial dynamic supports the serendipitous recombination of ideas. I asked for a translation, and Nee smiled. It's a narrow, small island and easy to have face-to-face interactions. Look how simple it was for us to get together today. You just walk out of your apartment and you can encounter someone useful. The secret juice of New York City is that it's very easy for people to meet. As a much-admired professor of sociology at Cornell and the director of the Center for the Study of Economy and Society, Nee goes well beyond making observations while dog walking. He spent 2 years gathering millions of points of data on, as he put it, every instant when people got together to talk about technology. He collected information on the 50,000 members of the New York Tech Meetup, an organization that holds monthly meetings with speakers as well as social events and parties. He added in information on smaller, specialized sessions that members organize and meetup groups in specific fields and much more. He realized that people in the tech world attend meetings and parties big and small so they can be part of the swirl of ideas constantly percolating when creative people get together. Those face-to-face meetings are important because most innovation is about taking existing ideas and recombining them, Nee said. All the encounters increase the chance that someone will come up with a new combination. To people looking in from the outside, it feels like extraordinary luck when something original